I'm back in the at the Abbey. So I want to say buenos tardes a los jalapenos and los torreones and to everybody else who speaks English. So let's start out by cultivating our motivation and rejoicing that we have a precious human life and the opportunity to practice the Dharma, the opportunity to hear the teachings and transform our mind. And let's make a strong determination to make good use of this opportunity by studying the Dharma, thinking about it, meditating on it, and integrating it into our daily life. And to do all this in order to attain full enlightenment for the benefit of each and every sentient being. So cultivate that motivation. Okay. So last week we talked about we finished talking about the 7-point instruction of cause and effect for generating bodhicitta. And tonight, even though it isn't here in this text, by the third Dalai Lama, we're going to talk about Shantideva's method for generating bodhicitta, equalizing and exchanging self and others, because this is a very, very powerful method. So just like the 7-point instruction on cause and effect, this other method, equalizing and exchanging self for others, begins with equanimity. Okay, so equalizing our feelings towards friends, enemies, and strangers, smoothing out the playing field so that we give up the attachment to friends, the hostility towards enemies, and the apathy towards strangers. So we start on that foundation. Okay? Then we go from there to equalizing self and others. So equalizing self and others is different than equanimity. Okay? So equalizing self and others, there's a 9-point meditation, and it's broken into 3 different sections. So the first section is about others' viewpoint, and the second section is our own viewpoint, viewpoint of the self, and the third is the ultimate viewpoint. So those are the 3 major sections in the equalizing meditation. So then, under each of these, there's 3 sub-points. So looking at sentient beings from the viewpoint of others, okay, so first here we contemplate that everybody wants happiness and doesn't want suffering equally, that there's no difference. So not only is there no difference between our friends, our enemies, and strangers, all of them wanting suffering, all of them wanting happiness, none of them wanting suffering, but there's also no difference between ourselves and others. Because sometimes we might get it where we can equalize friend, enemy, and stranger, but even this takes some work. Because somehow it feels like our friend's happiness is really more important than stranger's happiness, isn't it? And stranger's happiness isn't so important, but it's definitely more important than enemy's happiness. Remember, enemy means anybody we don't like, or who we feel threatened by, or afraid of, or hostile towards. Okay, so it takes some energy to see, actually, from the viewpoint of those sentient beings, they're all equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. You know, we can't say that our friend's happiness is more important, or that they deserve happiness more, or that they want happiness more. Okay, so all of these categories of beings are equal. But in addition, our own happiness, wish for happiness and wish to avoid suffering, is equal to that of other sentient beings. Okay, so that's really cutting to the chase. You know, it's like, okay, friends and enemies are equal, but still my happiness is more important, and my suffering hurts more. Okay, right? I mean, when we go through the day, don't we think that way? Whatever's convenient for me is, of course, the best thing to do, and if it's inconvenient for others, it doesn't matter. If something is disturbing to my mind, we should get rid of it. It doesn't matter if it brings happiness to somebody else's mind. Okay? If I'm miserable, if I have a cold, if I have the flu, if I'm unhappy, if I don't get what I want, it's total national catastrophe. I mean, it's the worst thing that could happen in the world. But if others, you know, don't get what they want, if they get a cold or, you know, have some problems at work, it doesn't matter so much. Okay? Isn't that how we act in our daily life? You know? I mean, the prime one is more important is me. And the world just needs to figure that out. Get it all straight. Okay? So this first point is really, you know, really hits that self-centeredness. And we begin to contemplate that actually the intensity with which we want to have happiness, others want happiness with that same intensity. And the intensity with which we don't want to have not even the slightest irritation, let alone great misery, is the same intensity that everybody else wants to be free of it. And just to sit there, you know, on our cushion and let that sink in and make many, many, many examples in our life, you know? And you take and you think about, you know, your other family members, you know, especially your kid who's screaming at the top of their lungs, and you just want them to be quiet. You know, think, well, my happiness and wish to be free of suffering is just as much as that child's. Okay. Might be easier for your own child. Take somebody else's kid. Okay. And then take a colleague at work. Take a big kid. And really sit. They want to be happy and not have suffering as intensely as I do. And so do this with selected individuals in your life and really sit there and feel that and think about how these beings, they have actual lives, they have actual feelings. You know, they want happiness, they don't want misery. Because so often we treat people as if they just don't have feelings at all. It's to really think about that. And I think this is especially good when we think about groups of people that we might have some misunderstanding with or some prejudice towards, okay? Because all of us are prejudiced towards everybody who isn't us, okay? Because we happen to be the center of the universe. But, you know, as we go out, there's all sorts of different groups of people that we feel a little bit uncomfortable with, you know? Maybe you don't like to be with little old ladies, or you don't like to be with adolescent boys, or you don't like to be with this group or that group or the other group. You know, you feel uncomfortable, you feel ill at ease. And to sit with the fact that they want happiness and to be free of suffering as intensely as we do. And to sit there and think about Osama bin Laden and George Bush and, you know, who?
Charles Manson.
And, you know, whoever it is. And really think that. I mean, somebody, yeah, like Charles Manson, who, you know, you might feel rather horrified with. Or, you know, here in the Abbey we have our kitties. And we also have a lot of stink bugs. And we have mice, and we have chipmunks, and, you know. And it's very interesting because it's easier to have affection for chipmunks than for mice. But why? Why do we look and, oh, chipmunk, how sweet, I don't want it to get hurt. But a mouse, well, not so important. You know, on what basis do we make that discrimination? Just because a chipmunk has a few more colors than a mouse does. Yeah? They're both from the same rodent family. But look how prejudiced we are. And let alone mice. Mice sometimes can be cute, but what about rats? Okay. Or what about mosquitoes? Or what about skunks? Yeah? So we can see that, you know, our equanimity, our equal feeling towards other, it's equalizing self and others. It needs some work because, you know, everyone that we consider like us or very cute, we can understand they want happiness and not suffering. But those who aren't so cute to us, you know, then we don't really care. Yeah. When we look at a little baby, you know, oh, baby's so cute. You know, we say, oh, we want that baby to be happy. But then if we saw that baby 80 years from now, and they're old, you know, and they're crotchety or whatever, then, oh, we don't want to be around them. They don't look nice. Okay? I mean, look how much discrimination we have there. So really to spend some time on this and just sit with, you know, but they want to be happy and not suffer as intensely as I do. And get in touch with how much you want that and then think that's exactly the same for them. There's no difference. Okay? So that's the first point. Then the second point is that we should help others equally. Or put it this way, we should have the wish to help others equally. We can't always help them equally because we may be closer to some and, you know, physically closer or whatever, according to our social roles that we're born into. We may or may not be able to help others more or less equally. But we should have the wish to help them equally. So it's as if we were walking down a street and there's a whole line of beggars. Yeah. And when you go to Bodh Gaya in the winter, you know, you see this a lot. When His Holiness is teaching in Dharamsala, all the beggars come and they just line the road because it's good begging, you know. And how, you know, to be able to look at each of those beggars and help each one of them equally. Because even with a bunch of beggars, we might tend to favor one over the other, think that one wants happiness or you know, deserves to be free of their suffering more than others. But to really think, no, they're all similar. And then to generalize that to all the sentient beings, because it's all like we're beggars to some extent. We're all wanting something, aren't we? We all feel like we need something. And so to have the wish to provide what sentient beings want or need in an equal way, just as with a group of beggars, yeah, to help, to have the mind that wants to help them equally. And then the third point is similar, but here we're talking about a group of patients, okay? So a group of six people, they all want to be free of suffering equally. It's not that one wants to be free more than somebody else. So to have the attitude that wishes them to be free of suffering on an equal basis. So with, in other words, not favoring some over others. And this is mentally. Like I said, in actual life, we may be closer to some people and it may be easier to benefit them. And so we take advantage of that ease in benefiting or that ease in removing their suffering. But mentally, to have some kind of equanimity towards all of them in terms of seeing them as wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. And in the same way, to think that just as all those 10 beggars, one might want, you know, rice, one might want dal or lentils, one might want a shirt, one might want some medicine. Everybody wants something different, but they all want happiness equally, even though they might want, they might see different external things as bringing them happiness. And so similarly with all the people that we encounter, you know, one person wants praise and one person wants you to help them with a job, and another person wants you to clean the coffee counter, but they're all wanting something, and it's a way to provide them with happiness. And similarly with the 10, if we had a whole line full of people who were sick, one might need one kind of medicine, one might need another kind of medicine, so they might need different kind of medicines to alleviate their suffering, but they're all equal in wanting to be free of that suffering. Okay? So that is from looking at sentient beings and equalizing them from the viewpoint of others. In other words, we look at all those others in these different ways and see that however we do it, everybody wants happiness and wants to be free of suffering. And if we put ourselves in that mix, we line ourselves up. We're one of those beggars. We're one of those sick people. Okay? You know, we're sick from afflictions and karma. Then, you know, we're just our wish to be free of suffering, like the ill people, our wish for happiness, like the beggars, you know, completely equal to theirs. It's not that ours is any more intense or any more worthwhile or deserved. This is a hard one for the ego, don't you think? For the self-centered mind? Because inside, we're saying this is all very nice theoretically, but when it comes down to it, my happiness is definitely more important, and my suffering definitely hurts more. You know? Because that's what we're aware of all day and all night. Everything about me. You know? So we have really so much bias and prejudice, don't we? Towards me and against everybody else. Of course, we believe in democracy, and there's one of me and gazillions of everybody else. But that doesn't matter. Still, I'm more important. Okay? Somehow trying to get over that hump, and it's going to take some work. Yeah. But we start and we make progress. Okay, then, the second major heading under the equalizing one is looking at it from the viewpoint of ourself. And so here is to think that all sentient beings have been kind to us equally, and thus to develop an attitude that wants to benefit them equally. So really, again, thinking of all sentient beings as having been kind to us in an equal fashion, this too is very unfamiliar with us, you know, unfamiliar to us. We think, oh, my friends, yeah, they benefit me more. Then my family benefits me. It might be for you first your family and then your friends. But this person is the one who benefits me the most. That person over there doesn't benefit me at all. Okay? So, you know, we usually make so much discrimination according to how much benefit we see ourselves as receiving from others, and thus so much discrimination according to how much we want to benefit others in return. But if we look at the big picture and see that we've had infinite previous lives, so we've had every kind of relationship with each other, then we see that we've received incredible aid and benefit from each and every single person, in each and every single living being, not just human beings, in all the different ways that we could ever receive benefit. So the people that we don't trust now in a previous life saved our life. And to really have a big mind, you know, pull ourselves out of just the vision of this life. Pull ourselves out of this narrow thing that thinks I am just who I am now in this body, and everybody else is just who they are right now in this body. Because that's not even true in this lifetime, is it? We all change so much. Even within one lifetime, we're not the same. So let alone from one lifetime to the other. And when we've been born in different relationships with each other, then, you know, so many opportunities to have received benefit from others. Okay. Then the second point here is, you know, we might come up with some doubt. Oh, yes, others have been kind to me. that they've also harmed me. And then we can sit and do single-pointed meditation on the harm they've given us, can't we? You know, we can sit and ruminate on that for a long time. They did this, and they did that, and they did this, and they did that. So, yeah, they've been kind to me in previous lives, but boy, they've also been rotten to me this life. And, in previous lives, too, they've been rotten to me. Okay? So we could have this doubt of, well, they've been kind, but they've also been mean. Okay, so why should I care about them equally? Okay. But then, this point here is to realize that the care they've given us, the benefit they've extended to us, far outweighs the harm. And to really look at that, you know, in so many relationships that we've had with people, because relationships are always mixed. There's always some benefit and there's always some harm. So you might start with a friend where you can easily see that how a friend has benefited you, but they also sometimes, you know, your friend may do something you don't like, but to see actually that your friend has given you more benefit than they have given you harm. You know, so you can see that in terms of a friend. And then take it to strangers, you know, okay. Well, in previous lives, they benefited me so much, they may have harmed me. But if we look around in any of our lives, the amount of benefit we receive from others is far greater than the amount of harm. Because everything we have is due to the kindness of others. You know, we all feel like, you know, I'm an independent person. Especially American mentality. You know, I'm independent. I don't depend on nobody. I'm doing my own thing here. You know, and it's weakness to depend on somebody else. I'm in control of my life. But actually, if we look at our life, you know, we're so dependent on others. We all had lunch today. Yeah, where did the food come from? Yeah? How much of the food we ate did we grow ourselves? With nobody else's help whatsoever. We might have planted the seed, but somebody else tended the plants and somebody else picked it. Okay. We look at the clothes we're wearing. Where did they come from? Did we grow the cotton? Did we invent the synthetic fibers? Were we the sheep that gave ourselves the wool? You know? I mean, the clothes we wear, again, comes from the kindness of others. The place we're sitting in right now, other people built it. Even the water we drink, yeah, somebody built the well. Somebody devised the water system. We flip on a light and there's electricity. And we can see things, you know. Where did the electricity come from? We didn't build the electric plant. We didn't do the wiring. We didn't make the light bulb. We didn't make the switch. You know. So if we look, every single thing we have in our life depends upon the effort of others. So this feeling that we had of, you know, I'm an independent person and I don't depend on anybody, and depending on others is weakness, that's a bunch of hogwash. It's totally false, isn't it? And we're so dependent on others. And the fact that we're alive shows that other beings come through for us. They didn't leave us in the lurch starving. You know, we've had food. They didn't leave us naked. There's been clothes around. They didn't leave us homeless. We have a roof over our head. Yeah. We have medicine. It may not be the medicine we want, but we have something, okay? And so if we look, you know, everything we use, even right now, you know, I'm talking to you over the telephone. Who in the world made this telephone? I have no idea. But there was certainly a lot of sentient beings involved in making this telephone. Yeah, besides, what was his name? Alexander Graham Bell, yeah. You know, so more people than just him made this telephone. So if we look, we receive so much benefit from others. Now, if we compare that to the amount of harm that we've received, the amount of benefit far outweighs the harm, doesn't it? Now, if we think about it, you know, people may have hurt our feelings one time or another, or done something we don't like one time or another, but how often does that happen? And to what extent? And even when it does happen, we're still receiving so much from the benefit of others because we've managed to survive and live through all those things due to the kindness of others who have helped us. And so to really see that, you know, if our mind starts recounting everything everybody's done to harm us, to sit there and really make very clear to our own mind that the amount of help we've received far outweighs the amount of harm. It's really, really important. Remember Lama Zopa when he was teaching this meditation one time, and he was telling us, because in his previous life he was a lama up in Lhasa in the Sherpa area of Nepal, near the Tibetan border, near Everest. And so after he was identified as an incarnation of that lama, he would go up there sometimes in the summer and stay in that area. And he was telling us one day how some of the local people, you know, they would bring him offerings because people have so much reverence for the Sangha. And they don't have much up in Solokumbu, at least in those days they didn't. Now they probably have more. So they brought the staple food, potatoes. And Rinpoche started talking about, you know, how he sat there and somebody brought him potatoes and he just looked at one potato and it was, and seeing how many sentient beings were involved with the production of that potato. You know, the people who planted the seed and who cared for the crop and who harvested it, and then who carried it to him, but they carried it in, you know, these baskets made on their backs. So who made the basket, and who grew the reeds to make the basket, you know, and who were the coolies who carried it, and, you know, who made their clothes, and who gave them food, and, you know, and as he started thinking about this whole interconnected web of sentient beings who were all involved somehow in this one little potato growing and then, you know, getting to him where somebody's offering it. And he said when he thought about it, it was as if the feeling of how kind sentient beings have been to him was so strong, and how much he depended on sentient beings and was indebted to sentient beings for their kindness was so strong, he said he could barely accept this offering. You know, he felt so uncomfortable accepting one potato, you know, let alone this whole basket full of potatoes, because he saw so much kindness all these sentient beings had put into it. You know? And it just really struck me, you know, that when you feel that kind of connectedness with other sentient beings through feeling their kindness, then really it's like, you know, it's like accepting things from them is almost too much, because the kindness is too much. It's like overwhelming. How could I ever repay that kind of kindness? You know, and yet really wanting to repay it. Okay, and so, you know, really contemplating this very deeply, and then, you know, any thought that, oh yeah, but they harm me, just, you know, fades in the background. You know, who cares about that? Because we really see the continuous benefit we've received. And then the third point in this one of the viewpoint of self is that since everybody is going to die, there's no sense in discriminating or judging anybody. Now this is a big one for our judgmental mind, our opinionated mind, our sportscaster mind that likes to sit there and call out comments about everybody and every little movement and action that they make and every small way that they look. Okay? But if you think about it, we're all going to die. So what use is there holding a grudge against anybody? What use is there judging anybody? Yeah. The person we're going to judge is going to die. Why do we wish harm on somebody who's going to die anyway? You know? When you look at sentient beings, people may look healthy, and they might look rich and happy, they might look in control, but they're all going to die, every single one of them. So if they're going to face the misery of death, what use is holding a grudge against them? What use is judging them? What use is wishing them ill? It's really kind of disgraceful, isn't it? No? When you think about it, somebody's going to die, and we can sit there and hate them? It's like they're going to die anyway. Why? What use is hating them? So, you know, when you think about this in terms of the capital punishment, you know, all these people who are, you know, some people might hate because they harm their relative or their friend, and, you know, they think that killing this, you know, the perpetrator of the crime is going to bring them some relief from the crime, you know, some relief from their pain. I mean, that's so misconstrued. They're holding a grudge against somebody who's going to die. They're wanting to kill somebody who's going to die. You know, who's going to die of natural causes anyway. What use is, you know, spending so much energy hating them and wishing them ill when just by the fact that they're a sentient being under the control of afflictions and karma, they're going to experience the misery of death in any case. You see what I'm getting at? No, it's like, how can we wish somebody else harm? It just doesn't make sense. Because if you sit, you know, and you think of somebody who you resent or somebody who you don't like, and we have a lot of negative feeling towards them, then, you know, here's this sentient being wanting happiness, not wanting suffering. They're going to die at some time or another. They're going to get reborn. They may or may not know about the Dharma, so they may or may not have a good rebirth. They may fall into the lower realms. What use is hating them? Yeah? Totally useless, isn't it? And what use is it thinking that if they die, my pain will be removed? Because they got what they deserved because they harmed me or they harmed somebody else I live. Is that really going to take our pain away? I don't think so. So to really sit and think about that, let that, you know, sink into our heart. Because we've all had pretty horrible thoughts about others at one time or another, haven't we? We all look nice, but, you know, we've all thought, gee, I wish a truck hit somebody, or, you know, if I weren't so nice, I'd go out and drive the truck myself, or, you know, who knows what. I mean, incredible things go through our mind, don't they? You know, that we think somehow it's going to make me happy if this got enacted. But then think about it, you know, it's a sentient being who's suffering under the control of afflictions and karma. Why wish them harm? They're going to die anyway. Get reborn. Who knows what they're going to experience. You know, it's a pretty sad situation when you think of their being stuck in samsara. Okay? So, these three points, you know, under the viewpoint of self, it's really emphasizing, you know, from our own viewpoint, yeah, there's no sense in discriminating amongst other sentient beings or between ourselves and others. Yeah. And there's no sense in, you know, and there's more sense, put it this way, there's more sense in having equal-hearted, open concern and care and affection for everybody, because they've all benefited us. Okay, so that's that second main point. Then the third main category, or the third main point, is that from the ultimate viewpoint. So I really like this one. I have very strong memories. A Sensei Second Rinpoche was the one who first taught me this meditation. I've received it a few times from him, and it made a very strong impact on me, especially this last section. So from the ultimate viewpoint, okay, if there were truly existent friends, enemies, and strangers, if there were truly existent me and others, then the Buddha would see this. Okay? Because the Buddha has no obscurations in the mind. You know, a Buddha sees everything that exists clearly as it actually exists. So, if there were truly existent friends, enemy, and stranger, if there were truly existent me and others, so that I was more important than them, and my happiness was more important, and my suffering was more important, if all these things really truly existed, the Buddha would see them. The Buddha does not see this. Okay, the Buddha does not see truly existent friends, enemies, and strangers. Okay, and from the Buddha's side, the example they give is one person could be sitting on one side of the Buddha stroking him, and somebody could be sitting on the other side of the Buddha stabbing knives into him. From the side of the Buddha sees both of them with equal-hearted love and concern and compassion. Okay. The Buddha doesn't see, oh, this one's a truly existent enemy and that one's a truly existent friend. Yeah. He just sees that those things are bubbles, you know, karmic bubbles coming into existence due to causes and conditions at one particular moment of time, and they will change very, very, very quickly. When you think about that, that's really much more of a correct view, isn't it? But we hang on to it. Oh, somebody was nice to me. They are the most wonderful person. Yeah. Somebody was mean to me. They are the most horrible person. And we see them as always holding those roles, always being like that. You know, an inherently existent idiot, an inherently existent wonderful person. Yeah. Buddha doesn't see anything like that. Why? Because people don't exist as inherently existent friends, enemies, and strangers. Okay? Then, the second point under this ultimate one is if there were inherently existent friends, enemies, and strangers, then these relationships couldn't change. Somebody who is a friend now would always be a friend. Somebody who is an enemy would always be an enemy. Somebody who is a stranger would always be a stranger. Because they were truly existent like this. But that's not the case, is it? Well, when we were born, everybody was a stranger. Think about that one. When we were born, everybody was a stranger. We were taking care of strangers. We moved into a stranger's house when we were born. And they thought we were the most wonderful thing under the sun. Yeah? Every parent loves their baby. Even if we were an accident, you know, still they love you when you come out. So, you know, if people were inherently existent friends, enemies, and strangers, then these relationships would always be like that. Somebody would always be a stranger. Somebody would always be a friend. Somebody would always be an enemy. But that's not how it is it? You know, everybody started out as enemies. Some of them became friends. Then some of the friends became enemies. Some of them went back to being strangers. Some of the enemies became friends. Some of them went back to being strangers. the relationships are always changing. Yeah. And it's interesting to think about it, you know, because some of us here, we've known each other for different periods of time. Well, you know, think about, okay, let's say 20 years ago, none of us knew each other, did we? Yeah? So 20 years ago, or even 15 years ago, we were all strangers to each other. We were all strangers. We were all in the stranger category. Like, who cares? Now we sit here, we're living together, we really appreciate each other, we depend on each other a lot, not just physically, but we, you know, function as a community, we help each other as a community, you know, when we need encouragement on in our practice, when we're upset about something, we support each other, so we're friends now. Then once in a while, we get mad at each other, then we go into the enemy category. But 15 years ago, we were all strangers, didn't care beans about each other. And it's interesting, isn't it, how much those relationships change? You know, some of these strangers, So there might be some stranger out there, but right now we think, who cares about them? We might meet them, and in a year there might be somebody who's really, really important and significant in our life. We don't know, do we? There might be somebody who we can't stand now, who we think is really dreadful. Yeah, we meet them again in a few years. Or maybe, you know, we meet them next lifetime, have a totally different relationship, and we're very, very close friends. All these things are changing all the time. So just the fact that they change shows that they're not truly existent friends, enemies, and strangers. Okay. So when we look at people, we shouldn't see them as, you know, I know everything about you, you're like this, and you're never going to be anything but like that. Because as soon as we start seeing people like that, we just box ourselves in and make ourselves quite miserable, don't we? I know that person, impossible to talk to him. Can't talk to him, don't even try, just give up. He's like that. Now, as soon as we start thinking of that, I mean, we're really grasping true existence, isn't it? Aren't we? And it's useless because they're, you know, the other person's a changing phenomenon. Different circumstances, and we'll be helping each other. Then the third point under this is that just the discrimination, self and others, okay, just to the self, just this thing of self and others is merely labeled. Yeah. We really feel like there's an inherently existent me and there's inherently existent others. Okay? I am I. I'm me. I'm not other. I'm me. Yeah. And all you guys are other. You are not me. And we exist independent from each other. We do not exist as merely labeled. We do not exist in relationship with each other. Because I'm me and you're you. You know? And this is just inherently existent. Okay? Well, this is where I remember Sekhar Rinpoche, who was so great giving this teaching, because Alex Berzin was translating it. And Rinpoche was talking at that point that the discrimination of self and others is like the discrimination of this side of the valley and that side of the valley. Okay, from the abbey we look out, you know, we see the other hill. That's that hill. We're on this hill. Yeah, and we all agree with that. This is this hill, that is that hill. And we look at it as if it is, you know, independently, inherently existent. This is this hill, that is that hill. Now, all we have to do is cross-country lane, climb up a few hundred feet, and look back. And what was that hill becomes this hill, and what is this hill becomes that hill. Get what I'm saying? Okay? So the discrimination of this and that is entirely dependent upon the perspective from which you're looking at it. Well, in the same way, the discrimination of self and others is dependent upon which perspective you're looking at. From my perspective, I, me, and you're you. From your perspective, you're I, you're me, and I'm you. I remember she was teaching this. He was asking Alex, well, are you you or are you I? You know? And we were all laughing so hard. Because poor Alex was trying to translate this, you know. Well, I'm sitting here, but you're over there, but you know, from your perspective, you're sitting here and I'm over there. It's an interesting way to look at it, isn't it? I mean, just now talking to you. You're sitting here, I'm over there. And that's the way it looks like from your perspective, doesn't it? Yeah? I'm listening to the teaching and you're giving the teaching. Yeah? It's just merely labeled, isn't it? What is I and what is you? It just exists, you know, merely labeled, these discriminations being made in relationship to each other, because you can't have I and others inherently existent things. You only discriminate I and other in relationship to each other. Yeah. But then what you call I is totally subjective, because somebody else labels I upon their aggregates. I label I upon my aggregates. I label you upon your aggregates, but you label I upon your aggregates. So are you I or are you you? And am I or am I you? Okay? Because these aggregates that are sitting here, they can be validly labeled I, and they can be validly labeled you, can't they? These aggregates are valid bases. A valid basis for the label I, and a valid basis for the label you. So am I or you? Am I or other? We can't really find. Yeah? And but it's so strange, isn't it? Because we feel like each of us regards, there's a real I here. This is I, this is not you. Yeah, this is I. But then when you say, well, what is it that makes it I? Okay, there's a body, there's a mind. What makes this body and mind I and not you? Because according to democracy, these aggregates here are you. Because there's how many of you in the room? And you look over here and you all say you. I'm the only one who says I. You all say you. Yeah. And so, of course, you know, you think, oh, your happiness doesn't matter as much as my happiness because you're labeling you on my aggregates. How dare you label you on my aggregates? These are my aggregates. This is me. And my happiness is the most important thing. Don't you dare label you on these aggregates and think that I'm less important than you because you're you. Your aggregates are you, you know. So they're definitely less important. You see? Yeah? So it's funny, isn't it? Because the whole I and you thing is totally subjective. Totally subjective. You know? And to really, you know, sit there and think about it, that in many people's eyes, I am you. You know, could you imagine that? That many people regard me as you. How dare they regard me as you? But actually, there's more of you regarding me as you than there is of you. No. There's more of you regarding me as you than there is of me regarding you as I. Yeah. Because for each one of us, there's only one person regarding that person as I, and everybody else regards us as you. So shouldn't we always refer to ourselves as you? We believe in democracy. So if everybody voted, I'm you. You should call me you. And if we had democracy, then each one of you actually should be I. No, not for democracy. According to your own view, each one of you would be I. And then I'm you. And there's more eyes out there than there is you sitting here. So isn't my happiness more important than others? And since I is a valid label for all of you, then isn't your happiness more important than my happiness? No, I'm sorry. Isn't my happiness referring to you more important than your happiness referring to me? Okay? Do you see how subjective it is? And yet it's so strange, isn't it? As soon as we say the word I or you, we have such a strong feeling of some inherently existent person. Yeah? Like there's only one I in this world. Well, there's not. Yeah? There's all these different I's. And how come I label I on these aggregates? I mean, that's a really interesting thing to sit with in your meditation. How come I label I on this body? Well, first of all, who is labeling I on this body? But what is I about this body? Yeah? What's you about your body? Why can't I label I on your body? You label I on this body, on your body, and you say I want happiness and don't want suffering. Interesting free card, isn't it? Really see how relative, how dependent these things are. That I and others, I and you, are not truly a system. Just depends on the perspective. And so subjective. Okay, so that's the equanimity meditation. And you can see that as you go deeper in it, it's really cutting away our way of thinking of I am more important and you are less important. My suffering is more important, yours is less. My suffering hurts more, yours doesn't hurt as much. Yeah. It's an interesting thing, you know. Why do I label I on this body? Well, because I feel the sensations from this body. Oh, why is that? Why do I feel the sensations from this body? And who's the I that feels the sensations from this body? And what's the relationship between the I and the body? Especially if others look at this body as you and don't feel the sensations of this body. Okay. So as we meditate on this, what we want to get to is a feeling of there's no difference between friends, enemies, and strangers, and there's no difference between self and others. Okay. And not just in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, but even in terms of who is labeled self and who is labeled as others. You know, that this distinction between self and others is not so clear at all. Okay, so we have time for a few questions. Yeah.
For me, somehow this play of labels doesn't make much sense.
It doesn't make
much sense? Oh yeah, I kind of really make not notice it. And when I try to do this kind of meditation, what comes in an obstacle is that, well, the discrimination I seem to be doing between me and you is about experience. I mean, I experience my back pain, and I'm not experiencing your headache, for example. So that is what I have come to be able to overcome.
Okay. So I don't understand this meditation. It doesn't make much sense to me, discriminating between you and me, because I experience my pain and I don't experience your headache. That's what I'm saying. That's what she's saying. Who's saying it? Her or me? You or me? It's from the perspective of me, because we're very locked into our own perspective. You know, since beginningless time, we've been grasping onto true existence and feeling the strong existence of I. And so it at the beginning, this kind of meditation absolutely makes no sense. It seems like just a play of words. Because like you said, I experience my pain and you experience your pain. But if you really sit down and think about it, what does it mean, I experience my pain? What does that really mean? And is that an objective reality, I experience my pain? Because other people are saying, you experience your pain. Is it an objective reality that I am I? Why can't I be you? What would happen if I looked at my pain as your pain? Instead of labeling it my pain, what would happen if I labeled it your pain? What would happen?
Who would take care of the pain?
What?
Then who would take care of the pain?
Oh, she said, then who would take care of the pain? Well, this is the thing. Why do we only take care of our own pain?
But if I have a back pain, I won't give you an ibuprofen because it will change my pain if you take my ibuprofen.
She's saying that if she has a back pain, she won't give me an ibuprofen because it won't eliminate her back pain. But what's your back pain?
An experience?
No, you can't say I. It's your back pain. It's your back pain. You can't say my back pain. You have to say your back pain.
Is it yours?
It's yours. No, it's very interesting. It sounds like a word game, but we grasp on to words as having so much inherent existence that it can actually be very interesting to play with this. And what would happen if I called my pain your pain? Yeah? And in the same way I would say, oh, you don't feel well today, that's too bad. Let's go out and do something. You know, get over it. And looked at our own pain as we would somebody else's pain. It's your pain. Because what makes it my pain? You know, it's like we have such strong grasping at my. My. You know? And is it really pain or is it just a sensation? Yeah? And similarly with happiness, you know, my happiness. Well, is it happiness or is it just a feeling? And what's my about that feeling? And what's happy about that feeling? What about that feeling is happiness? Yeah? That's another one that's real interesting, you know? Like when you're miserable, you sit there and say, what about this feeling is misery? And when you're happy, what about this feeling is happiness? What about it is mine? and you just to start to question that a little bit, you know, because we do grasp that things are so inherently different. There's this chasm between you and me, you know, but it's all just because we're grasping at that inherent existence. You know? I don't believe you. You don't believe me. Who is not believing who? Okay, so all the people on the call, all the eyes out there, I have a lot to think about. And I hope all you eyes talk to each other and discuss this and figure out who you are and figure out why you, who is I, think that your suffering, which is my suffering, is more important than anybody else's suffering. And same with your happiness or my happiness. Okay? So think about it in your meditation a little bit. Yeah? And then also do the other points regarding this, you know, seeing sentient beings as equal and the whole thing about the uselessness of holding grudges. You know, a lot to think about there, isn't there?